Hey, Houston. For a limited time at VisionWorks, you can get two complete pairs of glasses. Frames, lenses, the works, for just $49 on single vision glasses and $89 on progressives. And that's a good deal. But we offer that pricing on over 500 frames, which makes it a great deal. Right now, buy two complete pairs of single vision glasses for just $49 or two pairs of progressives for only $89. VisionWorks, we're here to help you. Some restrictions apply. See store for details. Offer expires November 10th.
Who are the unstoppable ones?
Is it just that they can do it and I...
Who are the unstoppable ones?
Is it just that they can do it and I can't?
Who are the unstoppable ones?
Is it just that they can do it and I can't? Mission unstoppable. Mission unstoppable.
The unstoppable ones.
You did say unstoppable, right? You did say unstoppable, right? What is it they know that I don't? Coach Frankie Picasso takes you on Mission Unstoppable.
Who are the unstoppable ones?
Can anyone stop these people?
Good evening. I am the unstoppable Frankie Picasso, and tonight you're about to go on another Mission Unstoppable. My guest this evening might have been a great prize fighter, given his penchant for taking on anyone who stands in his way. However, instead of choosing the ring, he chose to get a BA in psychology, and a good friend assisted him with his decision to become a teacher. Stay tuned, stay close, and we'll be back in just a moment. This is, again, the Unstoppable Frankie Picasso. If you're listening to us on Tuesday, November the 2nd at 8 p.m. Eastern, then you have tuned in to the live version of the show. Please feel free to participate by calling into the show at 646-595-3741 and hitting 1. Also, you can join us in the chat room, which is now open. And if you're listening to the archive, thanks for downloading it. And feel free to contact me if you need more information at frankie@missionunstoppable.com. I'd also like to take a moment to thank the good folks here at Blog Talk Radio for allowing me to broadcast over their network, as well as TogiNet Radio, who broadcast this show on Thursdays at 8 p.m. I'd like to also thank all of you who tune in to me each and every week. So, who is this instigator, this advocate, this rebel, this warrior teacher with a cause, who has been taking on the education system for the past 50 years? At 78, Dr. Robert Rose, author, educator, psychologist, seems to be ramping up instead of slowing down. He has his own radio show and video show on YouTube. He's a marketing machine. He's written educational books, including Joys of Teaching, They Touched My Life, which won the Reader's Favorite Award for the Best Education Book of 2009. He wrote The Complete Teacher, The Creative Teacher, Our Extraordinary Year in Dad's Class, as well as Abuses of Power in Education, Challenging Practically Everything, and Racism 70 Style. He also wrote two personal psychology workbooks entitled Creating Your Giant Self and Self-Awareness and Self-Discipline. He wrote Caregivers and Survivors. He is the creator of a teaching methodology he calls Imaginative Curriculum, and he's helped thousands of students change their lives, both in and out of his classroom. Robert's now turning his attention to chronic pain, and I could go on, but let's let the good doctor speak for himself. So good evening and welcome, Robert Rose.
Wow.
How are you?
I'm amazed that I'm such a wonderful person. That was quite an intro. I couldn't ask for a more well-rounded and accurate portrayal. No, thank you.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you. So you have, it seems like you've written a gazillion books. Did you write 8 books and many more? It seems like you wrote like 16 books or something. How many books have you actually written?
I think on my website I got about 20 books, including the workbooks. Got a couple of workbooks. One is TV Can Make Your Child Smarter, and I changed it to TV Can Make You More, Can Help in Reading, Writing, and Thinking. So all those things, everything that I did was something that I actually did in the classroom. I know one year I read an article in the Claremont Reader's yearbook, and this guy was talking about how to do a reading. And when I read it, I thought, what the hell is he talking about? So I looked it up, and the guy had a PhD in reading, but he had never taught a kid to read, you know, in a classroom. And I thought, what is wrong with that picture? And this is the kind of things that happen, you know. People that put themselves out as experts who have never been in the classroom I just don't consider them much of an expert.
Well, all of us have been in a classroom because we've all gone to school. Most of us have anyway. And we have that experience to draw from, I would imagine. But also, we've had a variety of different kinds of teaching methods and different kinds of teachers and different schools. And I wanted to know, where was your first teaching assignment? What area of the United States?
I graduated from UCLA, and then I went to teach in an area in LA called Palms, and it was in a low-medium income, basically a redneck school. That's where I started.
Okay. What grade?
I started with a 4 or 5 combination, and
okay.
I didn't really learn much about education at UCLA. I think they learn a lot more now, but I didn't learn much, and so everything was on the spot learning, and that's what happens to a lot of teachers. They get thrown into the classroom, and it's like thrown into the den of lions, and they don't know what to do. But it doesn't happen as much now. And I know at Cal State, where I'm a professor now, as an adjunct professor, these people that come out now, they are magnificent teachers. I'm telling you, they know what they're doing, and it's very exciting to see them.
Well, you started in 1961 teaching?
1959.
So the classroom has certainly, that landscape has changed, I would imagine, dramatically. I think I was in grade school through the 60s, graduated in 74. So a lot has changed since then, and a lot, you know, changed before I got there. So I would imagine when you first started teaching that discipline, you were allowed to discipline kids yourself?
No, we weren't allowed to touch them. We weren't at L.A. We're not
really?
To touch them. We weren't allowed to discipline them except, like UCLA said, now boys and girls, don't you want to do it this way? And of course the kids would say no. You know, I think it's funny. One other friend of mine, he's 83, and he's written dozens, a lot more stuff than I have even. And he says, you know, it's interesting that people think that, you know, the old days that things were different. Actually, the structure, the problem with schools is the structure hasn't changed since the Puritans had it. I mean, we're still in the same ridiculous structure, and that's what the problem is. We have the technology now to change education dramatically. We have the material technology. We also have the emotional, intellectual knowledge about brain, the way the brain works. I just did a review on a guy's book called Beyond Biology by a neuroanatomist and a neurosurgeon. It was a magnificent book about how the brain operates, and we don't really recognize that in the way that we teach. So we have everything that's necessary, but we don't use it because we're in a structure where there's a boss. Things come down now from God and high, you know, in Washington or Sacramento, wherever, and from your district, and the respect for what the teacher sees with the child is ignored. And that's why we're failing. And the standardized tests, are besides being ridiculous, are asinine. I mean, would you like to be judged as a radio host on one factor? No.
Well, yeah, right? No, of course not.
Well, that's
yeah.
what they're doing with the teacher. One test.
I think, I think the standardized testing is ridiculous. It really does depend upon, you know, your life experience and where you come from and where you've been, and schools are different. I went to both public and private. I can attest to a dramatic difference in one and the other.
What was the difference?
In private school, I had a classroom of 10 kids. You know,
okay.
There was 8 or 10 kids in a class. So we definitely got, we were expected to work at a higher standard, well above our grade range. And when I went to public school, I had been in public school, got out of public school, went to private school, then went back to public school. And I was thrown into a school where there was like 2,000, 3,000 kids.
Right.
And there was 200 kids in my English classroom. Like, that was just crazy. So I didn't adjust very well to that. But
But see
beyond that.
But that's what's good. You see, you were like I said, you were a rebel. I like those kind of kids because you were not letting the BS that they said, you know, you have to follow directions when the directions didn't make any sense. And that's what happened in the public school. The directions don't make a lot of sense. Nor does the curriculum. This guy Marion Brady says the curriculum is crippling our nation.
But when you go from a classroom, Robert, when you go from a classroom of, you know, you used to have maybe 20, 22 kids in a class in public school, in grade school, elementary school, and now you've got 35, 40 plus kids in a class. I know that you like to give individualized attention. You like to create, you know, curriculums for each and every one of those kids individually based upon who they are. And that's fantastic, but is that realistic?
Yeah, but, you know, you can do that with a larger class. I did it with 42 kids and sixth graders. When we go out to the yard, it was like a thundering herd because the kids in that particular area at that time, these were big kids. The kids had been failed a couple of times. So I had 13, 14-year-old kids in my sixth grade class. So, I mean, these were huge kids. And yet I was able to individualize with them. That's when I started developing individualization. And it isn't that I make a new curriculum for every kid. That would really be almost not impossible. Now, with Internet, that isn't even impossible, but it's much more difficult. The thing is that the individualization is the time that you range the classroom so that you can spend time with individual children. That's what really individualization is, and the teacher gets to know that child and then helps the child and the parent find things that the child is interested in, because an interested child is a child that wants to learn and will be educated. When we do like we do in regular school, we coerce. That's the basic thing about education is coercion. Mm-hmm. It starts from the very top. They coerce you all the way down to the kids. If you don't do exactly what you're told, you're in trouble.
Well, I call that socialization, and I've got a real problem with that too. I guess I've always been a little bit of a rebel at heart. I don't like to be squeezed into a box and told what to do. But don't all kids like to learn, especially kindergarten, grade one? Aren't they curious? They have this desire, I think. All children have a desire to learn until something happens. Do you think that's true?
Well, what do you think happens?
I don't know. What happens?
What happens
well, I think
is... I'll give you an example. I'll give you a good example of what happens. I was at a school, and I was evaluating... My student teacher was in a kindergarten class. And then the class got up and then moved out of the room, and they were walking, and there was another kindergarten class walking, and all the kids, one class, the kids had their hands on the back of the shoulder of the kid in front of them. The other class, the kids were walking with their hands behind them. And it looked to me like this was, prisoners. They were prisoners.
Yeah.
They were walking like a bunch of prisoners. When I had kindergarten and first grade kids, when we'd walk out, we'd sing, you know, and laugh, and I always took the room that was the closest to the playground so they could run out the door and go out in the field and play, you know, and enjoy themselves. But that's not the way it is. They march the kids to place to place. It's more like a prison system. And you know, when you think about the classroom, I had a lady on that does Feng Shui,
mm-hmm.
and we spent a whole hour talking about how to make the classroom more livable and beautiful, because they're ugly. You know they're ugly.
They are ugly. But what about this idea of not being allowed to touch now? Can kids hold hands? Are they allowed to hold hands? Can they hold hands in a circle and sing and dance, or is it hands off?
I think it depends on the principal and the teachers. I've seen, like I said, that one school, you know, the hands-on was like in the prisoner thing. Otherwise, you know, don't touch anybody.
I think that's ridiculous. I think they've just gone beyond stupidity.
It's unhealthy. It's unhealthy.
Yeah.
But the reason for it is because when teachers have hands-on, when that's a kid touch, you know, that's the hands-on. They push each other and they fight and everything. And it's because they don't sit down and spend the time for the kids and the teacher to make up the rules. And the rules should be made with the children, not for the children, but with the children, so that they know why they're making the rules up. And the rules have to be things that the teacher can actually follow through with. And when they make, when the she and the children make the rules, they should also make up the consequences. Because I don't know about you,
I really like that.
Because my kids, my own children, when they did something wrong, they had made the rules. They had to come up with a consequence. Like one of my sons, the thing that he hated was being penalized by money taken away from him, or he had to pay us money if he did something, because he hated
uh-huh.
that. And he knew that was the thing that would change him. My point about rules is and punishment is that punishment should make some sense, and it should fit the crime. The child should have due process. If all these things happen, then kids can hug each other. They can touch each other because it's not done in hostility. But when you
mm-hmm.
when you coerce kids and you make them sit down and shut up and they can't move, I mean. I had one class where the kids, I said, now, this is a new class. I said, you know, you can go to the bathroom when you want. You just have to sign out. If you need a drink, you go to the back of the room and get a drink. And they said, we can't drink that water. I said, well, this is sixth graders. I said, what do you mean you can't
yeah.
drink the water? It's poison. I said, the water's poison? They said, yeah. I said, who told you that? The teacher that came before you. And I said, think about it, you guys. You're sixth graders. You think that the district is going to put poison water in the school? And they looked at me and we never thought about that. I mean,
yeah.
a whole class of sixth graders and nobody ever thought about that? What does that say about how they have been forced and coerced to stop thinking for themselves? And that's what happened.
Yeah. And so this teacher told them it was poison water because she didn't want them getting up and having drinks and then having to go to the bathroom.
That's right.
Nice.
Crazy, huh?
Nice. This idea of not being able to go to the bathroom in schools is another thing I've always found ludicrous. You hurt their kidneys, you hurt their natural cycles in their bodies, and it's so silly not to allow them to go to the bathroom. Eventually, you know, I'm sure that you found that kids may have taken advantage of it a little bit at the beginning, but then they settled down. It wasn't such a big deal to get out of class.
That's exactly right, Frankie. And the reason the teachers wouldn't follow my lead is they say, well, you know, the kids abuse it. And I said, that always happens. I said, when you have people that have never been free, you know, and all of a sudden you
yeah.
open the cages, you know, then they have a tendency to run wild. And, you know, like the first day sometime with the drinking, you know, they'll line up about a half a dozen of them at a time. And then, you know, we have to set some rules. But
mm-hmm.
but I know that what I'm doing is I'm training them to be responsible. And the only way you can train people to be responsible is to let them accept responsibility and then face the consequences when they screw up. And then when you have the rules that they've made together, and then when they screw up and then they can choose their punishment, then they stop doing it. They stop abusing it. And I was what I call the self-sustaining classroom is that the kids felt safe because they knew that they were going to get justice. They also felt good because I was protecting them and the rules protected them from abusing each other. And so they became more and more friendly. They got along better. And I had less discipline problems, even though I usually took combination classes, and I took the kids that nobody else wanted. And the ADH kids and things, and they stopped being ADH because they were happy. They were secure.
Yeah.
They felt safe. Now,
I think that's pretty incredible. I think the idea of letting a child make rules, they're smart. Kids are smart. Basically, they're smart and they're fair, and they know what's right and what's wrong, and they're going to make really good rules. My son went to, my older one went to a kind of a paramilitary school where they were allowed to come up with their justice. They were allowed to fight if they believed that the fight was for something that was right. They wouldn't get in
mm-hmm.
trouble. But if it wasn't, they were also allowed to give their punishment. The punishment could be getting whacked. It could be getting smacked. It could be doing dishes. It could be doing anything. But they got to choose it. And if they wanted to get hit, they got hit. And a lot of the guys would choose to get hit just so it would be over. and the parents had to sign off, you know, a waiver saying that they know what they're doing, that if they get in trouble, that this is what, you know, they've chosen to do. And you know what? It was really quite brilliant. And when they did fight, they really did fight for something that they believed in. And they had to stand behind that. And I thought, wow, yeah. You know, it made them think about what they were doing, and the punishment was, they knew what the punishment was. So they have, they bought into it, right? Now you've got kids who have bought into what's going to happen. And I like the idea about safety, because a lot of times kids are at the mercy of adults, and they don't know what's going to happen. And adults will use fear to manipulate kids, and I think that's wrong. I think you're going to get a lot more from honey than you're going to get from fear.
I'm going to play on what you said about that paramilitary thing. I got the permission from the principal to teach boxing. I had a wrestling mat in my room. And if there was a conflict between kids, because a lot of times you'll have, when we talk about bullying, sometimes the bully is the one that's been picked on. You know, the little kid kind of teases the kid. And then so the kid who may be overweight or something, and so he starts pushing the kid around, so he's the bully. So what I had is that if you're teasing somebody, of course, and that period of time I could also SWAT kids. This was in San Bernardino when SWATing was a little.
See, as I said, you got to hit kids back in the day.
that was something that was, I mean, you don't have to do it now, but, I mean, that was helpful at the time. Because that was one of the choices they have. They could either be swatted, they could be sent home, or a lot of times I would say, you know, after they'd had their due process and everything, I'd say, okay, what do you want to SWAT? Do you want to be suspended or whatever else it was? And they'd say, well, I don't want either one of them, you know, and I'm not going to do this again. I'm not going to get in a fight, or I'm not going to say anything. And then I'd say, well, okay, that's fine. And teachers would say, well, you just let them get away with it. I said, well, what I did is the child knew that if he did it again, then his punishment would be doubled. And I said, what you're confused about is you're thinking he got away with something. I said, but my idea is that punishment should change the behavior. This child changed his behavior. And if he changed his behavior, then that worked. So you don't have to be, you know, don't have to brutalize him, or you don't have to punish him, because he recognizes he did something wrong, and he's going to change his behavior. And if you think of consequences as way of changing behavior instead of punishment, you just completely change your mindset. And that's how I had a different mindset about that. A lot of teachers thought, well, you just let him get away with stuff. But, I mean, their behavior changed, so they didn't get away with anything.
Right. I like the idea of kids taking responsibility, but you also ask parents to take responsibility for what goes on in the classroom. And how many of parents did do that in your time?
Well,
in
actually, what I did is the parent. I'd start out the year with a conference with a meeting with all the parents, because I was doing so many strange things like class. I had a classroom business. We did massage, meditation. We did sensory training. You know, we really had a strong human body component, because I felt that the kids really should understand their minds and body. You know, and that's why when we talk about, you know, getting a drink and everything, I would tell them, you know, I want you to be able to listen to your body. So the parents would sit down with me, you know, and I would tell them, these are the things that I'm going to be doing. But this is what I'm going to be doing in my classroom. Now, if you're uncomfortable with your child being in this situation, you know, talk to the principal and you can take your child out of my class. Because I don't want you second-guessing me, you know, or one parent coming in and telling me, well, I don't like what you're doing, or, you know. And I said, if your kid comes home with some kind of a statement, you know, that Dr. Rose said this or said that, I don't want you going to the school board or the principal. I want you coming to me, because we're going to settle it between us. That I respect your right at, you know, to protect your child, but I also think I deserve the respect for you to hear what I have to say, because kids do misinterpret what they hear, you know. And I said, I see constantly how teachers are being browbeaten by parents because of something that a child in the room said, and then it goes all through the neighborhood and everybody believes it. I said, we're going to clear it up immediately. If they have any complaints, you tell it to me immediately. You call me or come in. And also I said, you can come in my classroom. I said, the district says you can come in for 20 minutes. I said, you can stay the whole day. I don't care how long you stay. There's nothing that I do that I'm ashamed of or that I can't explain scientifically or logically. And if you can, if you tell me, well, I don't agree with this, and I'll listen to you. And if I think you're right, I'll change my program. So every year I lost anywhere from 1 to 4 kids, but I had
how many parents stayed?
Huh?
How many parents came into the classroom and stayed a whole day?
Nobody.
Nobody.
Nobody, because they said, well, this guy knows what he's doing. And then as soon as their kid was in for a couple of days, they said, you know, that they could see a change in their kids. Their kids came home happy. They couldn't wait to go to school. And that was something that never happened before. So they were very pleased. And also, I always found things good about a child. That was my skill. And so the child began to feel good about himself, and his behavior changed. Now, the other thing that I did with the parents is as I sent home every Friday, you know, information about what we did in school. Because, you know, when your kid comes home and you ask them, well, what did you learn today? And they say nothing. And I used to get me irritated. What do you mean to learn nothing? You know, so I sent home what we'd done, what we had done, or what we were going to do. And so that gave the parents some things they could ask the kids. Well, what about this human body? I guess we were talking about digestion today or this week. What did you learn about it? You know, so it gave them the basis to have conversations with the kids. But in the parent conference, we were forced to have a parent conference within 6 to 8 weeks, I think it was, when the kids, you know, the first semester. And what I did is I sat down with the parent and I would, instead of saying, you know, Frankie, you know, I've got these two papers on Frankie, and I can see that her reading, you know, she needs to do, you know, more phonics, and you have to give her more phonics. You have to read with her more at home, blah, blah, blah. I'd sit down with the parents and said, what do you guys do for fun? They looked at me like I was crazy. I said, well, I just want to know what was something about your family and how you guys get along. What do, you know? And then gradually as the conference went on, then I would ask more, I'd ask things about how they discipline the kid and things like that. But I made the parent relax, and I told the parent, I said, you know, this is your kid, and I'm going to do everything possible to make have a really good year for him. But I need to know a lot from you about him. I don't know that much about your kid. I just got a few papers. I've had some observations. But you've had this kid all your life, so you tell me about your child. And I had parent after parent say, you know, Dr. Rose, you're the first person that ever asked us anything. The teachers generally just sit there and tell us, you know, how bad our kid is or something else like that. And so that changed the whole thing. I also told him, I said, my job is to teach your kid. Your job is just to love him and enjoy him. And I said, I don't expect you to help him with the homework. I don't expect you to do anything that you don't want to do with him. I want you to enjoy him. My job is to teach him. I said, the homework, I'll take care of the homework. If he doesn't do the homework, that's my job as a teacher. It's not your job as a parent to force the kid to do homework. Because what I've seen is that homework usually ends up causing fractious behavior between the parent and the child. I said, it's ridiculous. Why should you have to be worried about what the kid does in school? That's my job. That's my job. But because they gave me free rein then. Yes, they would tell me, you do anything you want with my kid, you know, because I think you really know what you're doing, which I did know what I was doing. And so they gave me free rein. And so I didn't have to worry like a lot of teachers with some parent coming in, you know, and ranting and raving about their kid, you know. That hardly ever happened. And if it did, I handled it in a few minutes or a half hour, you know, and I would... Because if there was a problem in the class, and I would handle it. And
you wrote a book called My Extraordinary Year in Dad's Class, and that was a year that your twins, Arian and Eric, were in your classroom.
Right.
How old were they that year?
They were 11. They were 11 years old.
Okay, so it's pretty extraordinary that you had your own children in your classroom.
Well, the reason for it was the year before, my daughter Ariane had been in the fifth grade class in the same school I was at, and the teacher had totally scared her out of her mind. It was a fifth grade teacher, and so I went in, and cause she started having nightmares, and I said, "Well, what's happening?" She said, "Mrs. So and so, you know, she scares me, because she just looks at you and." And then, so I went in, I mean, I was on the staff, so I went in and talked to the teacher, and she just leveled at me, you know, "Well, you know, your daughter isn't doing anything. You know, she doesn't hardly do any work at all." So I said, "What is she supposed to be doing?" And it turns out that the teacher gave the kids, the first 3 weeks of school, the reading was 500 words to look up. 500 words.
Oh, God.
And when I came home, I said, "Ariane, how many words did you do?" She said, "Three." I said, "In 3 weeks, you did three words?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "Yeah." She said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, what was Mrs. Blah, blah, blah doing?" "Now, she was sitting at her desk. She reads while we read, you know." And I said, "Well, you weren't reading." And I said, "First of all, what she gave you was an asinine assignment."
Yeah, no kidding.
She's just looking up words, you know. And there wasn't absolutely no reading. And anyway, because of that, I got in conflict with the teacher and eventually with the principal, and they had a whole big hullabaloo, and I was involuntarily transferred to this other school. And the next year, the superintendent made up to me. He said, "You know, Bob, you really got a bad deal." And he said, "What can we do?" And I said, "Let me have my kids in my room for the year." My twins, and the principal was a real good guy, and he said, "Oh, yeah, you no problem. I trust you. You can handle it." And it was the best year of my life, without a doubt. It was just extraordinary.
Wow.
I mean,
it's so amazing, Robert, how one teacher can stand out for the rest of your life as someone who can make you or break you. And
yep.
I know for myself and my daughter, there was a teacher, a math teacher. And for a lot of girls, I think, there are math teachers who totally destroy them, and they think for the rest of their lives that they can't do this. They can't do math. It's something that, you know, they're just never going to be able to get a grasp of. And it destroys so much of their self-esteem. And it's amazing that children, and because I know this from private school, that children will work beyond what most teachers will think are their potential if given the opportunity.
Oh, definitely. That's what's so exciting to me. That's what's so exciting about being a teacher, is that you can you find things out. I had a fourth grade class in another district 1 year, and because I gave kids earned time. Earned time was after they were finished with whatever we were doing. If we had a 50-minute class, you know, and supposedly 50-minute math. If they got done in 10 minutes or 20 minutes, the rest of the time. They could do whatever they wanted. And, I mean, besides hitting each other, you know, within reason.
Yeah.
And they brought stuff in, and I brought stuff in. And it was a great system, because they were really motivated to finish whatever task they had. And so they bring in things. And 1 year, the girls brought in this record. And these were just fourth-grade girls. And I watched them. They did this during recess time, but I watched them dance, and I was just astonished. They were so good. I mean, I'd put them on So You Think You Can Dance or something like that. They were that good,
yeah.
And they were fourth graders.
Well, I was going to ask you the difference between girls and boys. Now, I have two boys and a girl, and I had boy and a girl twins, and you had boy and a girl twins. And you know, I gave them carte blanche with toys. You want dolls,
mm-hmm.
You want trucks, you want this, do you want that. And also, you know, watching their development, because I was very interested in the stages of development. Now, I found that my boys didn't like to read unless it was like a nature book, something that was nonfiction that had facts, you know,
mm-hmm.
Where the girls mm-hmm. like to read the stories. They like to read fairy tales and different kinds of stories. Now, how did you find that kind of thing in your classroom? And did you notice a differentiation in the way that you needed to teach boys and girls?
Well, that's the idea of individualization.
Sure.
And because it isn't
but
just
gender,
boys and girls.
Gender-wise,
it's
on a broad gender basis.
Yeah, there is a gender difference, you know. But I taught in a private school for 1 year, too. And I had these young girls that were, it was a fourth, fifth combination. And the girls at the first part of the semester, you know, they were such little ladies. They were so sweet and everything. But after 2 months with me, the girls were out there playing, and this one girl that was actually the littlest, sissiest little girl, she got hit in the mouth with a basketball, and she started bleeding. And so I said, honey, you're bleeding. You want to go in and go to the nurse? And she just said, no, I'm going to suck it up. And she sucked up the blood and just went back on the court. And it's amazing what you can change in behavior when they accept certain kinds of things. Like what I accepted is I did, you know, I didn't want to be brutal to them, but I didn't like the idea that kids, you know, especially the girls, were so wussy about everything. And I wanted them to be able to stand up to them for themselves. And that's what they started to do. So the behavior that is considered to be boys' behavior, a girl can be more masculine in that sense, more aggressive. And also boys can be more sensitive because, you know, we would do poetry. We would do, and I wrote plays for them. And one play, you know, the boy has to kiss the girl. And I'd say to him, well, you know, if you want this part, you're going to have to kiss the girl, you know. And they'd say, well, you know, I can't kiss a girl. And I'd say, well, why not? Well, because, you know, it's not very masculine.
They're girls. Yuck.
Yeah, it's a girl, you know. And I said, well, it's just a girl. It's a play. It's something pretend. And I said, anyway, you like her, the girl that was supposed to be the part. You like her anyway, so why wouldn't you want to kiss her? You know, so it was trying to get the kids to understand that what we do with each other, if it's thoughtful, if it's something that you want to do, and you see other people being able to do it, you know, don't be stuck in stereotypes. And a lot of the stereotypic thinking, you know, the girls can't do this and the boys can't do that. And what I try to do was to change that. No, it didn't always work with some kids, but and I didn't force them, though. I didn't force them, like the girl I told you. I didn't tell her that she had to stay and play, but she saw that, you know, like one time I fell down and I was bleeding and everything, and I said, well, we got another 10 minutes, you know, I'll wash up when we get done with the game. So I modeled the behavior, you know. I didn't start crying because I had a little blood on my hand or something, you know, and so they wanted to be like me in that way. And they wanted to be, you know, not wimpy in that way, and it made a difference in the kids. They felt good about themselves. When kids accomplish anything, they feel good about themselves. The problem with what we had, we went from coercion to persuasion in education, is that we started giving kids credit for almost nothing. You know, it's almost like you're gonna gold plate their poo poo. You know, anything they do is wonderful. And that's not healthy. You want to give them compliments for things that they do, that they know they've done well. And then when you do that, they start feeling good about themselves. When you give them compliments for stuff that they know they didn't do well, they know you're lying to them, and then you've lost them totally. And that's what happens to a lot of teachers. They lose the respect.
What about this
kid.
Idea? I want to talk about the idea, though, about phonics versus whole language. I had a real problem with that, because when my son was in grade one, I was teaching him phonics, and he went to school. He said, no, we don't do that anymore. They have to memorize words. I said, well, how do they memorize words when they don't know how to pronounce them? Like, I didn't understand that. Like, it just didn't make sense. And I said, well, that's what they have to do. And then that went on for about 3 years, and then they went back to phonics again.
I know.
So who was the genius who came up with that one?
The whole thing about, this is what Marion Brady and I both just get livid about, you know, the idea that everybody teaches phonics this year and next year we're going to teach whole language. It depends on the kid. And each kid their brains work differently. Different parts of their brains, like little modules, you know, and then they connect with each other. And some kids, you know, when Gardner came out with his seven or eight intelligences and things, and people came out with different ways of looking at, you know, right and left hemisphere. The real thing is that the brain is a very complex structure, and everybody's brain is very different. And so what you want to do is to give them all different kinds of things. You want to give them phonics. I taught the kids to learn the 220 sight words. We memorized them. And because I thought, well, if they knew the 220 sight words, they could read a lot of things. Essentially, about 90-95% of the words up to third grades are those 220 words. So if they knew those words, they would do fine. And my first graders, every year I had about a third of them could decode at a sixth grade level because I started that way. But I also taught them phonics, and I also taught them whole language. We did all kinds of things. Because even the kids that are visual learners and you know can do the sight words, they can still have the practice in visual learning, and it doesn't hurt them. It helps them. It reinforces them. And then if they're working on phonics, they're learning something that they need to learn. These are just different ways for them to access learning. And so the more different things you can do.
If you pick up a book, I mean, I understand that, but if I was to pick up a book and give it to a child who hadn't memorized 200 words and said, okay, how do you say that word? I don't understand how they could. Hello, are you still with me?
Yeah, well,
Robert?
I mean, how.
Yeah, like my computer just got infected. I don't understand how they could, you know, figure out a word if they weren't taught how to figure out a word.
Yeah, well, what I'm telling you is that, you know, you give them the word was, they look at the word, and everybody pronounces it, whatever way that you want, you know, or you mm-hmm. now that we have all the different kinds of mechanical things, you know, on computers and stuff, and the kids can have their own handheld computers, and they can actually talk into it, and then the word comes up.
Yeah.
I mean,
well,
the things that we have now,
now
are marvelous. So, I mean,
yeah.
And they're going to hear it, they're going to see it, and then you have them write it. And you know, I just couldn't understand how people could have a class for a whole year, even a first grade class, and most of the kids would leave and couldn't read, because most of my kids could read at the end of the first grade, you know, and I didn't understand.
That's pretty scary.
Well, it wasn't brain, you know, nuclear science. It was brain science, you know. I understood how the brain works.
Isn't that more the responsibility too of a parent to read with their child?
Well, I think it's nice. Like I told you, I didn't tell the parent
you had to read with your
kid, because one of the reasons that I didn't do that is some of the parents couldn't read, and some of the parents were not good readers. But the main thing that I was against was that parents would sit down with a kid, and when the kid would start reading, and he'd hold up on a word, and then the parent would say, "What's the matter with you? Don't you know what that word is? We saw it two times. I told it to you two times." You know, it just crushes the kid's spirit. When I would read with the kids, when they'd read out loud in the class, when they came to a word, I'd give them a few seconds to see if they could recognize it, and then I immediately gave them the word. And teacher said, well, how are they supposed to learn the word? I said, they'll learn it from repetition. They'll learn it from sight. There's all kinds of ways. But the main thing is that I'm not destroying their feeling about reading. I'm giving them help, and they knew that. And I'd have kids that come in, you know, like English language learners that were afraid to read out loud, and then within a month and a half, they were standing up and reading and fluently because they were comfortable. They knew that I'd help them, where a lot of teachers, you know, they intimidate, and the parents would intimidate their kids. Because the kids would tell me, "Well, I don't want to read with my mom or my read with my dad. He gets mad at me." And parents actually hit kids when they didn't get the word right. And so, why would I want to parents read with their kids? You know, but those parents, I said, especially if the parents were good readers and enjoyed reading with the kids or reading to the kids, I think that was great. You know, I said I didn't want to stop them from doing things with their kids, but I didn't want to make them feel they had to do that with their kids, because then they were doing my job, and the main thing is the fact that they would have conflict with their child, and I didn't want to be part of that, and that's why
after
I think
you retired. After you retired from teaching, you went back to teach.
Yeah, for 5 years.
Yeah. And but you had some problems in the classroom. You had some personal problems. You had your own problems.
You couldn't
hear very well. And you had
toxic
problems. So how did you manage that? Because I'm sure there's other teachers that have similar things that going on. How did you manage to handle that in the classroom?
Well, tell you the truth, it was really tough for me. That particular year with the one particular vice principal, associate principal or whatever she was, that was the first year in my life that I ever came home and drank every night. And that's one of the, I'm not proud of saying that, but I mean, that's what I did. I used to have nightmares where I'd wake up my eyes the size of saucers because I was dreaming of killing the bitch. You know, I mean, I wanted to kill this woman. It was that strong. And we were deep in debt, so I mean, I had to go back to teach. I had to pay off all these debts, and I was making a lot of money. I was making almost $100,000 a year because they paid me my regular salary plus my retirement. So I was making a bundle of money, and so I had to just choke it down. And I hadn't done that before when I taught. When I used to get berated by anybody, you know, I stood up to them and let them know where I stood on things. But I was on a contract where if I got in trouble, I could be fired the next day, and I knew that. And the assistant principal knew that too. So she'd stick her finger in my nose and on my face and say, "You will teach this thing or you will teach that way." She came in one time and told me, "I never see you teaching." She says, "I'm waiting to watch to see you teaching." And the reason she never saw me teaching because I didn't spend much time in front of the class. I was individualizing. I was working with small groups. And she didn't like that. She wanted me to do whole class lessons. And so this principal, this vice principal came in, and she was going to teach me. She taught about 5 years, and I taught about 45 at that time. And she was going to teach me how to teach a whole class lesson. And I know she spent hours and hours in preparation, you know, like a teacher can spend hours and hours in preparing for a lesson. And she talked to the kids this lesson with all these audiovisual aids for almost an hour. And I just watched the kids and they were afraid of her. And I just watched the kids as they just gradually got drowsier and less. And I watched her getting angrier and angrier. And so she never bothered me after that. she realized something there. And then there was a kid that acted up, and I actually almost put my eye out with a pencil. And I grabbed his hand and twisted it, and she bawled me out for, harming this child. And I told her the kid was psychotic. Next year he was in a mental institution. And I'm a psychologist, and I told her, I said, you know, he says, "Oh, you think just because you got a PhD, you're so smart." It was ridiculous.
Okay.
So, I mean, I understand what teachers can go through with principals. I've been through all kinds of things with principals. And
Let me ask you this. Your books are pretty graphic.
Yes.
You don't shortchange your vocabulary. You say it like
nope.
It is. Have you gotten in trouble with anybody for that?
Well, I think the reason I haven't gotten any trouble is nobody reads them. I don't think I've sold hardly any. So I think that's probably I might get in more trouble if it was widely read. I'd like your readers to read them. That'd be great. And I'd like feedback. But I feel that you should be honest about it, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not afraid of especially at my age, what are they going to do to me? Send me to my room?
Well, you know, I read your book. I read both of your books, the caregiver book and the complete teacher book. Now, in the caregiver book, which is kind of interesting, you even say at times that you know you'd like to kill your wife.
Yeah.
That she, you know, the bitch did this and that, and I'm thinking, wow. Now, I know that you love your wife because you say that throughout the book, how much you really love your wife. And there were some difficult situations with her memory loss and I guess with her being afraid to leave the house and things like that, and with you having to work. You went back, like you said, 5 years after you retired because you guys really needed the money.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, why I did that is because I think that... I'm not going to publish that book anyway, but the caregiver's book, the idea was that I see a lot of people, especially now, you know, the baby boomers are coming of age, and there are going to be a lot of them that are going to be either caregivers or being taken care of. And they have to
right.
understand that what they're facing is can be almost horrific. And as you saw in the book, you know, I said, when my daughter and I went to one of the Alzheimer's groups, and we saw the caregivers, these people looked like they were the living dead. The things
mm-hmm.
they were just totally exhausted, and they cried and they carried on because they're just so frustrating. I mean, I didn't face anything anywhere near that, and I was almost in a rage half of the time. So what I wanted them to understand is that I think it's normal, but there are ways that you can deal with it, and that's what I tried to show in the book, you know, that there
mm-hmm.
are ways to deal with your rage.
Besides drinking and doing drugs.
Besides drinking,
It's a difficult time for baby boomers. They are the sandwich generation. They have their parents and they have their kids.
Yeah.
And sometimes they've got young kids. You know,
yeah.
a guy 50, 55 might have a 2-year-old now, and then he's still got his parents to look after. So it can be very difficult.
I know my daughter. Go ahead.
No.
Go ahead.
I finished what I was saying. Your daughter was.
Okay. Well, one of my daughters, her husband's father lived with them for several months, and they made a little part of the house into a room for him and everything. And he just absolutely drove her nuts because, he put the room so he could have a place by himself. But he didn't want to be by himself. He wanted to be with somebody. And so he
mm-hmm.
was always around her. And he absolutely drove her nuts. And so they finally put him in an assisted living home. And it was a tragedy. He died soon after that because he didn't want to live. You know, he had nothing to live
yeah.
for. His wife died, so he had nothing to live for. So it's very sad. It's a very frustrating thing. So... But in all my books, I try to be brutally honest because I think that people should be able to recognize that that you don't have to be a sweet thing. You know, teachers don't have to be sweet little things to be good teachers. They just have to be honest with themselves and with their students. The teachers that the kids like are the ones that they trust because they know that person is going to be straight with them. And they,
mm-hmm.
My class, they knew they'd get due process. They knew that they would be treated well, and they were. And they treated me well. I mean, it was
You mentioned ADHD and that you had kids in your class that had ADHD that were diagnosed with it and then really didn't have it or weren't showing signs of it after being with you. You know, I always thought that by labeling them, we gave them an out, an out to be bad or an out to... be disturbing or an out to say I can't do things. What do you think about that?
I think the out was for the parents and the teacher, because when they gave them the label out, then they didn't have to treat them the same way that they would have to treat the rest of the kids. The kids would come to me and they'd say, well, you know, I'm ADH, and I'd say, well, I don't care that you're ADH. I said, you're a little kid and you're going to do the things that we do. We're going to have a good time and everything, and forget about being ADH, you know. And I would,
mm-hmm.
I changed the curriculum around, and I gave him a chance to be a person, you know. And the label is what kills the kids. It's like they have a new label.
It really does.
Borderline personality disorder. What the hell is that? Borderline person. How can you have a borderline personality? Either you got a personality or you don't have a personality. I can have a borderline.
So how much of these labels, you know, carry forward every year?
Oh, see, that's the problem. The child or the adult becomes the label. You get a label,
yeah.
Whatever the disease is, and you become the disease. It's
you found that out with your wife.
I didn't believe it. I didn't know.
Yeah, you didn't believe it, but the point was that the doctor had labeled her. Another doctor read her chart, labeled her, and so totally ignored her and only spoke to you.
Right.
And it wasn't your wife anymore. She was just the label.
Right.
And that happens to kids all the time.
Happens to kids all the time, and that's why I'm very hard about, you know, very strong about not doing that. But the thing about it, Frankie, is the fact that it's a natural thing for human beings to organize and you know, make some kind of label for people, you know, some way to understand them. And so we do this, we generalize, that's what our brain does. And that's one of the things I try to teach the kids is it's natural for you to generalize. It's natural for you to stereotype. But then you have to think about it and you have to begin to examine what happened and see the person in a different light and not use the label as an excuse and say, well, they're just this or they're just that. And
I really hate name calling. Like, I didn't allow it in my house. I really, really didn't like it. And, you know, this generalization, whether it's bullying or it's just name calling or people think it's fun, you know, here comes clumsy. Those are things that get into people's subconscious and
right.
carry with them for the rest of their lives. True or not true, because, as you know, our subconscious doesn't know the difference between fact and fiction. And so once it's put in there, they're socialized with this, you've set them up for a lifetime of failure, really, until they figure out that what's going on isn't true.
Well, the guy that wrote Beyond Biology, his point was that your brain doesn't differentiate between reality and what's in it, what's happening inside. So the external things and the internal things are both very believable and very real to the brain. And that's
right.
what I'm trying to do now. I'm doing what I call pain management, and I just did it with one of my daughters who has a severe migraine, and she's in the hospital, and her migraine was just horrible. And I asked her, I said, okay, now tell me about your migraine. How would you describe it? And she says, well, I see it as two metal tubes going into my eyeballs. I said, okay, now. And all these things are coming from her. I'm not telling her what to think. I'm asking her because these are things that are in her brain patterns. I said, now, okay, now you got this picture. You've got a metaphor. You've got a visual picture. Now what I want you to do is get rid of those tubes. And so she's laid there, and I said, what do you see happening? She says, well, they're starting to break down, and they're starting to drip. I said, okay, now you know about chelation. So the pain that's in your brain is going to be chelated into those drops. Now start watching, and she quieted down. And then I did something else. I put my hand on her arm, and I said, as the pain leaves you, it's going to go into my hand. So we're going to get rid of the pain. It took 5 minutes, and she went from a level 10 to zero, and she'd had a severe migraine. So the point is, that shows how powerful the images that we can make when you individualize, when you sit down with a person, you can change their behavior. You can change how they see things. But it takes the time to sit with the person and actually relate to them. And that, to me, is what makes good teaching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that.
So
how do you motivate? Actually, we don't really have time for that. So why don't we tell folks where they can find you and they can find your books?
You can find most of the books on Amazon, but you can also, I think you put my website. It's on my website. And my email address is ic.
Tell them what your website is, because some people don't have the.
Okay, it's www.imaginativecurriculum.com, and my email
is ic. Okay.
It's icdrrose@gmail, and all they have to do is write to me, and I'll tell you how to get the books. But most of them are on Amazon or Barnes and Noble and things.
Okay, so you've been listening to Dr. Robert Rose, and you can reach him, as he said, at icdrrose@gmail.com if you'd like to have further discussions with him about education. Or you can listen to his radio show. When's your show on?
It's on all the time. It's usually
on
9 or 10 almost every 3 to 4 times a week. 9 or 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time.
Okay.
It's on IC.
All right. So you can look
for
that on
Blog
Talk
Radio. Yeah,
I see Dr. Rose on Blog Talk Radio, 9 or 10, almost every day, Pacific.
Right.
All right. Well, we're out of time. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Well, this was just absolutely a joy, and you are, as always, just a joy to talk to. And thank you for having me, and we'll keep in touch. Oh,
we
did you say you wanted me to call in on Tuesdays occasionally or something? Or was that just on the bottom?
No, that's everybody calls in on Tuesdays.
Okay.
But
okay.
It's a call in and have a conversation with us. But anyway,
okay.
Thank you so much. We're out of time. I got to go.
Okay.
Bye, everybody, and I'll see you next week for another Mission Unstoppable. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, Houston. For a limited time at VisionWorks, you can get 2 complete pairs of glasses, frames, lenses, the works, for just $49 on single vision glasses and $89 on progressives. And that's a good deal. But we offer that pricing on over 500 frames, which makes it a great deal. Right now, buy 2 complete pairs of single vision glasses for just $49 or 2 pairs of progressives for only $89. VisionWorks, we're here to help you. Some restrictions apply. See store for details. Offer expires November 10th.